In the world of education, bold leaders can be found at all levels and in all roles.
Yeah, at the end of the day, that's what it is. It's about the success of our students, right? If we're moving the needle for our kids and more of our students are becoming, proficient, joyful, readers, that's what's really going to keep us going.
Are you ready to embark on an adventure through the world of words? Join us on the Reading Revolution and let's explore the exciting world of literacy together. Hi, Laura. Thanks for being on the Reading Revolution. It's a pleasure to have you here.
Well, thank you so much. I'm really delighted to be here.
Well, we're really excited to talk about your book and talk about the 95% group and who you are and what you do. So I think that's the best way to kick things off. What is the 95% group?
Well, great. Thanks for asking. So 95% Group, we are an educational publishing company. We offer both professional learning and we offer classroom resources. In the area of literacy, I would say we primarily focus on the foundational skills. And our approach is really based on this body of research known as the science of reading. And the instruction, our methodology is really inherent to our resources, and it would be characterized as structured literacy. So explicit, systematic, sequential, cumulative instruction. We're called 95% Group. The founders of this company call the company 95% Group because we approach our work knowing that with evidence-aligned instruction, at least 95% of our students can learn to read. And I always tell people, that's kind of our North Star. It drives everything we do. We want to, we have a purpose statement that says we want to unlock the power of literacy for every child. And we really want to empower teachers with knowledge and resources and support to be able to develop students into strong readers.
So who benefits from the 95% group? Is it a localized thing or is this something that's open to anyone across the nation?
Oh, sure. Yeah, we are a national organization. And so we sell our resources. We sell our classroom resources and our professional learning all across the country into thousands of schools and districts.
And professional development seems to be such a cornerstone of education where even educators can't stop learning. They have to keep up with trends and they have to keep up with, the evolution of education. How often are people reaching out to say, hey, we need a little help in this area? And how fast do you respond to those requests?
Yeah, thank you for that. Well, first of all, it's huge. It's a huge need that teachers and all educators have for professional learning. Many of us, myself included, are not availed to this, again, body of research known as the science of reading and the approach that is considered evidence aligned to that body of research. Many of us were not availed to that in our teacher preparation program. And unfortunately, even though I went through teacher prep many years ago, we're still finding this to be true around the country that not a lot of our teachers coming out of teacher preparation have this knowledge. So professional learning, once teachers are in service, is critically important. And we know that it has to be ongoing, it has to be long-term, and professional learning is not just about knowledge. It's where it begins. Teacher knowledge will transform classroom practice, as Stanislaus Dehaene says. But what really makes the impact between knowledge and practice is ongoing coaching. And I think if you look at any field of endeavor, coaching is really critical for helping people improve their practice on whatever that might be. So providing teachers with a knowledge base, but then ongoing support and ongoing coaching is really critical for us to really improve our practice. And ultimately, a knowledgeable teacher with the right materials and the right level of support, that teacher is going to be the one that is going to really impact student literacy achievement.
So before I continue on that vein of our discussion, how did you get involved with the 95% group? Tell us a little bit about your background.
Okay, well, first of all, I came up as a teacher in the 80s, so, do the math. But I came up in an era of whole language, and I would consider kind of a constructivist approach, this idea that somehow students, if they're immersed in print, and if we model to them how readers, good readers look, that somehow they would kind of pick all this up. So that was really the approach under which I was brought up as a teacher. From teaching, I moved into administration and I moved to both building level and district level, but that really wasn't my calling. I think my calling was real in professional learning. And I look back now and I realized I taught many teachers, hundreds of teachers, maybe not thousands, on the principles of whole language and balanced literacy. What really changed for me, though, is I kind of had this ongoing sense of doubt, and I really started to question a couple of things. First of all, I started to question, why did we have this kind of general acceptance around the fact that, well, there's always going to be some kids who will struggle? You know, why did we believe that? I mean, if reading is a learned skill, why were some of our kids failing to read? Was that failure theirs? Or was that failure ours, right? If reading requires instruction and our kids aren't learning to read, is the fault the instruction? So I think that was one question that started to kind of change my own thinking. The second was, you know, we implemented a process called guided reading. And I began to question, well, in this guided reading approach, why do I have some kids who are doing really well in, let's say, K1? But then they start to fall off the edge in second, and then they really bottom out in third. You know, could it be that we are teaching kids habits that work with pattern text or heavily pictured text? Because we were teaching kids to kind of memorize patterns and look at the pictures. But once they got into text that was more complex, had we instilled in them the habits that they need in order to sustain them as readers? That was kind of the second question that I started to ask myself. And the third was, you know, I had people telling me that research really didn't have a place in education because, you know, we're dealing with kids and each child is different and every child needs different things. And, but I look at other professions and I think, you know, how can we use data? How can we use research in the profession? So those, I guess, niggling self-doubts really sent me on a quest. And that's where I discovered people like Marilyn Adams. You know, her book, Beginning to Read, Thinking and Learning About Print, was really a game changer for me. And I learned the work of Joe Torgerson and Linnea Airey and Louisa Moats. And that really changed the trajectory of my career and set me on a career focus of helping educators teach all children to read. And I have a mission statement on the wall of my office that says that I want to contribute in the best way I can to ensure that all children learn to read so that they can flourish as literate citizens of the 21st century. And I always go back to my own experience as a reader and how enriched my life has been to lead that literate life. And I really want that for our kids. So that really kind of led me, you know, to organizational leadership. And I worked with the Department of Ed in Wisconsin on Reading First. And that's when it really affirmed for me that research, the National Reading Panel research, for example, has a place in our profession. Then I went to work at an organization called the Roland Reading Foundation. This was a foundation started by a woman named Pleasant Roland, who's the woman who founded American Girl. And after American Girl, she took her considerable fortune and she decided to return to her roots as a teacher and publish a program called Super Kids. I started their professional development department and, you know, we kind of grew into a large national organization. And that's when I really, again, built on this idea that research matters, professional learning matters. Curriculum materials matter. We have to not only build teacher knowledge, but give them the right materials. And that's when I really started to internalize the power of coaching, and how important it was for teachers to have ongoing coaching. Then I moved from there. I worked as a chief academic officer for three different companies under the Highlights Education Group. Also, I became certified in letters. And I started doing a lot of national speaking engagements, and that's actually where I met Susan Hall, who was the founder of 95% Group. So, you know, when I look at all of these, you know, threads that kind of came together, and then I started working at the Reading League. I mentioned that to you earlier. And at the Reading League, I was hired to, you know, help them kind of grow, and especially in the area of chapters, grow the chapter networks. Which, by the way, I found out recently. I think they have over 35 chapters now throughout the country. I think they're headed toward over 40, which to me is just amazing. And the Reading League has just incredible resources for all of us involved in literacy education. And I had a podcast while I was at the Reading League, and that allowed me to have a platform with some of the key heroes that I had, but also, key leaders, kind of driving literacy transformation. So all of those threads together really helped me kind of get to where I am, from teacher to administrator to professional learning to organizational leadership, my passion for literacy, and my realization that we have to have professional learning and the right resources in teachers' hands, and we have to have coaching to support teachers, and we have to engage with leaders. All of those threads really brought me to 95% Group, where I'm their chief academic officer to support that professional learning, support that leadership, and also kind of help establish 95% Group's thought leadership in the space.
So you mentioned these questions that you were having. When you're looking at the way that you might have been, taught in your education to become an educator, the Piaget pedagogical approach or the Lev Vygotsky scaffolding, how does that work, those kinds of classical approaches to education work with the science of reading, or does the science of reading kind of push that aside? Tell us a little bit about how they might work together.
I think that's a really great question, because I think that science of reading is again, a body of research that informs our understanding of how children learn to read, what happens if they don't learn to read, what we can do about it. As a matter of fact, I'm going to read this definition to you. This is actually from the Reading League, and this is my go-to definition for the science of reading. It's a vast interdisciplinary body of scientifically based research about reading and issues related to reading and writing. So I always like to tell people, science of reading is not something we do. It's a body of research that informs our practice. So the science of reading is specifically focused on that. It does not preclude other sciences like the science of learning, the science of teaching, implementation science. All of those bodies of evidence are also important in informing our work in teaching kids to read.
So
Good
that's perfect
question.
because that actually answers. I wanted to know that definition just as a reminder too, because as you mentioned, the Reading League, Dr. Maria Murray's been on the podcast and another great reference. And I'm glad that had that relationship because that's how I was introduced to you and this new work that you're talking about, this book that you've written, The Courage to Lead. Let's talk a little bit about that. What was the genesis of that? What was necessary for you to say, you know what, I'm going to write this book because I think it's important for leaders to read.
Yeah, thank you for asking that. And actually, I think I'm going to read to you a little bit from my introduction, because I think that really explains the impetus and the reason. So here's what I wrote. I've had the privilege of working with, mentoring with, and observing transformational leaders over many years. And I've learned as a leader that maintaining a stance of looking outward to serve others from an inward integrity requires fortitude. It requires wisdom, vulnerability, compassion, and courage. Courage to be a continual learner, to self-reflect and redirect when necessary, to grow and nurture future leaders, and to hold and protect a vision in service to others. And this vision is especially compelling in the domain of literacy leadership. It is my strongly held conviction that to transform our current literacy narrative, which we must do, bold and courageous leadership is required. This is the most important work we do, and our students and society are counting on us. It is my hope that as you read this book, dear reader, that you will find some practical ways to take actionable steps to build a transformative literacy plan, and that you will also be inspired by the incredible leaders profiled within, all of whom inhabit the traits of courageous leaders and are continually serving others, ultimately, the students and their communities with passion and integrity. So that's really why I wanted to write this I've been in education a long time, and I wanted to be able to kind of reflect on lessons I've learned. So about the first third of this book is really about the implementation science. And that's building off of kind of the science of reading, which was covered in this first book, Science of Reading 2.0. So we build on that and really delve into the implementation science. The second third of this book is really about creating a roadmap around the phases of implementation that leaders can look through and explore. You know, what does it mean to create a long-term transformational literacy plan? You know, 3 to 5 years, sometimes longer. What are those phases of implementation, and how do you be a courageous leader through those phases? And then the last third of this book is profiles of courageous literacy leaders. And that to me is really rich in that they offer their wisdom, they offer their advice on what they have learned as leaders. And so I'm hoping that this is practical, but also is inspiring through those stories of leaders.
And I love the whole approach of making sure that these leaders are taking that ownership seriously of education. I mean, that's what we do with kids. We make sure that they own their learning. Well, we better be owning the way we're teaching these kids.
1,000%. You know, it is about agency, right? Like, how are we owning our responsibilities? How are we empowering others? How are we giving others agency to do this really, really important work that just has to be done?
So you just showed, the roadmap. And again, I don't want to get too far into it, and we can always go back and make sure that we're covering things that we might skip past. But how does this implementation process begin?
So that's a great question. And I think this is kind of what I've learned from others and just from my own experience. So I think it begins with the identification and a shared understanding that we need an innovation, right? For example, a school district in which 40% of their students are achieving proficiency in literacy. You know, how do we name that? And how do we come to a shared understanding that that is not acceptable, right? It's kind of like when I was sharing with you earlier how I had that doubt that why do we accept, if reading is a learned skill, why do we accept that there will be students who won't learn, right? So I think that identification, the naming, and the shared understanding of why we need transformational change, that's really, I think, where it begins. And then I think, you know, courageous leaders look at the data and identify that something must change, and there has to be a literacy initiative to change that narrative. So I think that's really the first step. And I think that need for change has to be elevated, and there has to be a coalition built around that. From that coalition, then we have to set goals and outcomes and make sure that those goals and outcomes and that coalition represent diverse voices, that we understand the scope of the work, that we study the implementation science along with the science of reading and the science of learning. And from those pieces, that we can create a vision and create an actual plan. So you mentioned the roadmap. So I think that's where it starts. But then I've outlined in the book a roadmap that really shows, you know, each of these kind of phases of implementation and what are some courageous moves throughout those phases. So, you know, we identify the exploration phase where we're setting a vision, creating a collaborative team to identify that need and the best innovation. The installation phase where we're securing staff buy-in and leadership support to build a literacy plan. Then we move into initial implementation, where we're trying things out, we're establishing systems of support, we're establishing feedback loops. You know, is the innovation or is the literacy transformation, is it progressing in the way we want it to? If not, how do we redirect? Full implementation, that's a fourth phase that I've identified in this roadmap. How are we skillfully using and integrating the information? And then, unlike other models for implementation science, I created sustainability as almost its own as its own phase. You know, how are we securing long-term commitment for continued growth? Because one thing I have seen in my own experience in working across not just districts, but also even, for example, at the state level with Reading First, all good initiatives can completely dissolve if we don't have intentional, purposeful planning around sustainability, right? How are we as leaders sustaining change, even when we perhaps move on to somewhere else? How do we sustain that change? So anyway, that's how we start. And then this roadmap, I think, is a way for us to learn from the implementation science, learn from the journeys of others. How do we move through that transformative change and ultimately sustain that change?
From your experience, when this implementation process begins with exploration, who are typically the folks in any given school district starting that exploration process? Is it the teachers, or is it the curriculum directors, other administrators, or is it a mixed bag?
Yeah, I think it's a well, first of all, I think it takes a really strong leader at building district level to really, I think, start the ball rolling. But it can also come from a more of a grassroots startup. For example, I write in the book to acknowledge literacy leaders. I write that in the world of education, bold leaders can be found at all levels and in all roles. Board members, higher education, district and building administrators, instructional coaches, classroom teachers, paraprofessionals, parents, community members, in fact, anyone who serves our students can act as bold leaders. These are leaders who understand deeply what children need to thrive in our complex, interconnected world. They understand that literacy is the gateway not only to students' academic success, but also to their ability to flourish in school and beyond. Most importantly, these leaders understand that literacy is a human right that can and must be guaranteed to all students. Their relentless focus on literacy for all is backed by the certainty that if we don't get literacy right, we don't get anything right. So when I start to define what literacy leadership likes, I really kind of try to empower the fact that all of us have a stake in this, right? So all of us can be part of this change. But in terms of like instigating and really starting the actual process of change, we need bold leaders in high levels of leadership to really say, name it. This is what we need to do. This is the coalition I'm going to build, naming those people that I just shared. And together, we are going to craft the plan. But we have to have a bold visionary who will set the vision, hold the vision, protect the vision throughout the scope of the work.
And when you talk about that sustainability, what kinds of things have you seen that schools who are implementing science of reading and those sorts of things, the successes that they have that keep it sustainable, what do those sort of situations look like?
Yeah, so interestingly enough, I've just filmed a couple of podcast episodes myself. One was with an incredible visionary leader named Robert Palazzo at Panther Valley, and this is in Pennsylvania. And then a pair of leaders, Rob Friel and Brian, oh gosh, they're in the book. Rob Friel and hold on, give me one second. Brian Cromer, sorry, Brian. Yeah, Rob Friel from Southwestern School District. I was able to interview them for a podcast, and really, they were, and they're all profiled in this book here. It's really interesting. So I'll share with you some of the words of wisdom that they have shared in their experience, which I found to be true in other places that I've had the opportunity to work with leaders. Number one, knowing that transformational change takes time. This is not a 1-year initiative. That we have to have shared vision and we have to have shared goals. And that vision has to be, as I mentioned before, we have to protect that. Leadership has to protect that. Another thing they've all named is we have to have an honest and ongoing look at data. We have to have those conversations where we address any gaps in data that we have, because, if we believe, like our North Star, that with evidence-aligned instruction, 95% or more of our students can learn to read, and our data shows us that here's where we are. This is the gap of opportunity that we have to bridge, right? Another factor I think that will allow us to have sustainable transformational change is transparency and Relentless communication, both internal communication, but also external communication. You know, our communities have a stake in our students being educated and literate. And so making sure that we're communicating both internally and externally. I mentioned professional learning, obviously professional learning and coaching for everybody. You know, everybody's a reading teacher. I have had the opportunity to do professional learning and speaking engagements to people who work with older students. And oftentimes they say, you know, I have students in my class that aren't proficient readers. I don't know what to do. This was never part of my upbringing or part of my professional learning because I'm a content area expert. So making sure that professional learning in literacy is provided for everybody. Another thing that I think that they will, that everyone attests to, and this is what I've seen as well, is that every district or school that undertakes transformational change needs to have in place a collaborative problem-solving process where we're able to, you know, look at data, make action steps, come back together, see if those things have worked, reflect, review, revise as necessary in a collaborative space. And that requires us to have, I think, both agency but also accountability. How do we balance agency with accountability? And then also, I do believe that all of these leaders would attest to this. We have got to invest in hiring and training and delegation, you know, to make sure that an initiative will continue to proliferate. So one of the people that I am really intrigued by is Simon Sinek. You might know him, and he says, you know, a star wants to see himself rise to the top. A leader wants to see those around him rise to the top. So how are we empowering those around us to continue to be leaders in an initiative? And John Maxwell, I'm a big fan of his. This is his book, High Road Leadership. He says, you know, a leader is not great because of his or her power, but because of his or her ability to empower others. So that's just a few of the things that come to mind when I think about, you know, how do we create a successful process?
And what a wonderful concept of that idea of collaboration and sharing the success stories. As a PR person, you know, that's what I love to do. I want to share everyone's success story. And I would imagine that that would keep things sustainable and keep everybody in a positive moving forward. Let's not take the foot off the gas when they see their colleagues, or whether it's in their school district or a school district a few towns away, when they see these things happening. All of that should be shared. And I would think that that would just keep everyone focused on that goal and motivated to continue that development on their end.
Yeah, at the end of the day, that's what it is. It's about the success of our students, right? If we're moving the needle for our kids, and more of our students are becoming, you know, proficient, joyful, you know, readers, that's what's really going to keep us going, right?
So when these teams are together, what are some of the things that you do see happening in the classroom, and you know, something that, you know, a fellow teacher might learn from when this process is implemented?
Yeah.
We're now past exploration, we're in it, we're knee-deep in moving forward. What kinds of things do you see that help make the program, you know, with any program of literacy, positive and just keep rolling forward with positive results?
That's a great question. You know, I want to go back to, you know, this collaboration and this idea of, you know, the collaborative approach. So first of all, I would say there has to be a well-defined process for collaboration. Otherwise, there's no real collaboration, right? So the process includes things like making sure we have meeting protocols and meeting norms and clearly stated goals, you know, just things that keep us focused as a collaborative team. Also, you know, how do we think about, for example, grade level teams and intervention teams coming together to look at data and to drive instructional decisions? So the members of that team need to know that there's a value of their collaborating together. That when we collaborate, we're pooling diverse experiences, we're bringing together diverse perspectives, we're fostering continuous learning, we're supporting a, you know, we're creating a supportive environment, and we're trying to create an educational experience that is consistent for all of our students, right? So when we think about, you know, data-driven teams and implementation teams and innovation teams, we have to kind of look at the data. Here's our goal, right? Here's where the data is. How are we determining what next steps we take with our students? How are we reviewing and revising those steps that we need to take? And if we do this collaboratively, we're seeing the kids as our kids, not my kids and your kids. We're not playing a blame game here. You know, this group of kids is not doing well, this group of kids is. It's all about our kids collectively. And what are we as a collaborative group determining to do about all of our kids?
And how do we make those goals that you mentioned, for lack of a better term, juicy, where someone might say, oh my gosh, our proficiency level is here. How in heck are we going to get up there? And how do you make it to be not a massive, horrible mountain to climb, but more of a lofty aspiration that is attainable?
Well, first of all, I think we do have to ground everyone in the research around the idea that indeed, you know, with again, I go back to that, you know, that our North Star with evidence-aligned instruction, you know, kids can be taught to read. Reading is a learned skill, and it's something that can be taught like other learned skills. And so I think making sure that we all hold that as a belief is really important. And that comes with knowledge. That comes with building knowledge. That goes back to my question I had as a young teacher. Why are we just accepting the fact that some kids won't read or that some kids will struggle to read? You know, so how do we make sure that we all have that, you know, kind of inner belief that with the right instruction at the right time, you know, that our kids can learn to read? You know, I had the privilege of listening to a wonderful, I think at the time I heard him, he was a principal, but he's now a superintendent in Bozeman, Montana. And he said that he kind of woke up in a cold sweat, not literally, but when he realized that in their school and in their district, they had all kinds of, you know, mission statements on their walls. You know, we believe we can succeed, you know, all these things. He said, but I really started thinking about literacy. Do we really believe that all means all, right? When we say things like all students deserve a chance to learn to read, we all believe that, but do we really, we all say that, but do we really deeply believe it? And so I think a lot of it starts with just being informed to know that that aspiration that we have for everyone is achievable. So can we expect that kids can learn to read? That I think it kind of starts with that. And then secondly, let's remember that, you know, getting to meet our goal, it's not going to be a quick fix. It's not going to be a 1-year endeavor. It's going to be a multi-year endeavor. So we have to look at incremental steps of success, which is why when I go into schools where they have, you know, shared data rooms, which again, they're looking at our kids. They're looking at how are our kids performing and how are our kids improving? And those students who aren't improving, what are we doing to provide them with additional layers of support or additional layers of instruction? And being just that tactical with each and every child so that we start to see those incremental steps of success. So we have to have kind of this goal up here. Know it takes time. And know it's going to take incremental steps of success along the way. Does that answer your question?
I think so. And while you're answering that, I was thinking about, even a more fundamental kind of bedrock with the materials that kids are working with. How important is it to have those sorts of materials differentiated for differentiated learners?
So thank you for asking that, because at 95% Group, we produce what I consider The very highest quality materials that kids, that teachers use for instruction, and that kids use in instructional settings. So, first of all, I mentioned earlier that, our materials and our approach is really based on the research around the science of reading, but also an approach that we would characterize as structured literacy, explicit, systematic instruction. And when you look at how students learn to read, the majority of our students really require, well, the vast majority of us require instruction because reading is not natural. I go back to my own experience and the way I was brought up as a teacher, that somehow reading was like speaking. And if we just immerse kids in literature, that somehow they'll learn to read. Of course, we know that's not true. Reading is a human invention. It isn't very old. It isn't universal to all spoken languages. Not all spoken languages have a written component. So we don't have the neural pathways or neural mechanisms in our brain to just magically, voila, learn to read. And those systems, those neural systems, are really built through instruction. And the vast majority of us require instruction. Even some of us who maybe kind of seemingly very easily or naturally learn to read, we still had to build those systems, right? So the vast majority of us need instruction. And the majority of those of us that need instruction require some explicit systematic instruction. In other words, it has a better track record than haphazard instruction, a little bit here, a little bit there. So the instructional materials, when we think about the foundational skills, of which understanding that there is a code to the English language that has to be broken for us to learn to read, breaking that code does require a sequential, mastery of skills that really require us to look at the least complex to most complex in a sequential way and build on that. So instruction really has to follow that protocol. Now, we also know that having a what's called a gradual release model of instruction, I do, we do, you do, has a very good track record in teaching people learned skills. And again, look at any kind of learned skill, and you'll see that there's that gradual release. I do as a teacher, we do together with coaching, and you do with monitoring and coaching. So we have built our materials, and I think other really good, especially foundational skills materials, will be built on those principles of sequential, cumulative, explicit instruction that follows a gradual release model. So it's really important that teachers have instructional expertise. And that really comes not just from the science of reading base of research, but also from learning, the science of learning. There's a whole body of research around just the science of learning. And so when we put those things together, we have to think about what are the practices that teachers use in order to enact those principles to get the best bang for our buck, right? The best return on our instructional investment. I also think it's important that we put these materials in teachers' hands. Many times I've seen teachers go through professional learning and they learn about this thing called the science of reading, right? They learn these principles, but then they have to go back to their schools where they're given materials that are antithetical to those principles, right? So again, coming from 95% group, the beauty is the what we know about the science of reading and the science of learning and instruction really come together in the materials themselves. And the last thing I would say that, and this is something that those aforementioned gentlemen that I mentioned talking to in my pod in a recent podcast, they all said that it was really important that they had materials that, through the use of their materials, provide some level of professional learning for teachers. So when you have materials like ours at 95% Group that have good instructional dialogue, right, that follow an I do, we do, you do approach, that use consistent terminology between, across grades, that is really helpful for teachers. And then the last thing I would say about the importance of instruction and materials is we want to make sure that across all tiers of instruction, those materials are consistent. In other words, students, tier one is core, instruction for everybody. Tier two is intervention. Tier three is intensive intervention instruction. And students who require intervention and intensive intervention should not be doing something completely different. It should be additive instruction. It should be consistent and coherent with this core instruction so that the kids are getting more time, more intensity, and more targeted instruction as they receive more intervention. And that intervention, when I mentioned targeted, has to be informed by data. We have to have good diagnostic assessments that tell us as teachers, wow, this child is not at benchmark. How do I know what to teach? I'm going to administer a diagnostic assessment that will help pinpoint for me what that student needs so that I can intervene for that student with that focused instruction and get them back on track.
We've talked a lot about the positive aspects of all this, and not that this is a negative one, but what are the kinds of challenges that educators might come across when working in a collaborative effort?
Oh, that's another good question. So I think, one of the biggest challenges we have is time. Many teachers and leaders that I talk to say that they're just challenged with finding the time to meet in collaborative groups. They're challenged with having enough staff so that they can work with small groups of students. One of the most successful models for to speak about intervention, for example, is a walk to intervention model where we identify students, we target their needs, and then they go to, meet with teachers and other staff members in small groups to get just right instruction at the right time, making sure we have enough staff, to be able to do those kinds of practices. So, time, scheduling, staffing, I think those are things that I hear quite a bit in terms of challenges for a full implementation.
Well, let's touch back on the book. What was your favorite part of putting this book together? What was your favorite part that you would say is, writing it down and then looking back on it and going, man, I really enjoyed that part of the process?
Yeah, well, thank you. So I am really inspired myself by hearing stories from some of these incredible leaders. And I had the privilege of, before writing the book, having a series of webinars where I, kind of profiled some of these leaders. I've had the privilege of the podcast, or I've been able to speak with some of these incredible leaders. So I think trying to tell those stories was really the best part of this because I admire so deeply. And I admire and respect, and I'm just filled with gratitude for many of these leaders, especially those who are working in building levels or district level positions, who are every single day, in classrooms with students, with teachers, really trying to do the work that makes a day-to-day difference. So being able to profile them and tell their stories was probably the most gratifying part of this. And I'm pretty awestruck when I think about some of the work that these people have done and continue to do.
Where can people find the courage to lead?
So it's on our website, so www.95%group.com. You can find it there. And by the way, 95% Group, it's written out, and you can find it there. We have a, it's called a, it's a, is a portal called District Leadership, I think is what it's called. But anyway, you can go to our website and you can download it there.
And talk a little bit about this podcast that you keep mentioning. Where can people find that?
Oh, thanks. Well, it, you know, okay. So for, well, first of all, when I was at the Reading League, I had a podcast, which still, I think you can still access it on the Reading League website. And honestly, there were just some amazing people, on that. But then I was mentioning recently, I took over what's called TeacherCast. Some of you might know the TeacherCast website. And I had the opportunity to talk to those gentlemen I mentioned. I also talked to Kimiana Burke. Some of you know her as a national literacy leader. So those were really, I think, enriching conversations that people can check out. That's TeacherCast.
Perfect. And talk a little bit about what's coming up. Anything that you can share with us that's coming down the pipeline?
You bet. Well, thank you for asking that. So we are really excited, first of all, because I'm really excited. I think our, and our whole organization, we're really excited because we're doing good work. We're producing materials that teachers find helpful, usable, teacher-friendly. We always say that we have a teacher-centric approach. With that being said, we're also really listening to the market and their need for digital assets. And so we're kind of undergoing some digital growth. For example, we have a really wonderful, I think it's a one of a kind, it's called a literacy intervention system. And it's where teachers can assess students and from the assessments, group students from those groups be pointed to the materials that they're using in the classroom and being pointed to the instruction that they're using with those materials. So it's kind of this wonderful ecosystem approach that has been a hallmark of 95% Group, encapsulated in the journey from assessment to instruction for our students. And it's very teacher accessible and teacher friendly. So continuing to work on that, on providing digital assets for teachers that will really make their lives easier, transform their instruction, provide a level of professional learning with through the use of those materials, both digitally and in print, is really a hallmark of ours. We have this, again, ecosystem approach I've mentioned, where we make sure that there's a through line from our materials, whether they be core materials or intervention materials, that they do follow those principles of practice around consistent, coherent, integrated instruction that follows the, as I mentioned before, the gradual release, the explicit instruction. So I think we're going to continue, we're simply going to continue to expand our ecosystem to offer more resources to teachers and to offer many digital resources that are really accessible and high quality materials that really help to make a teacher's life easier. I would also say that ease is one thing, but also accuracy, making sure that we have accurate data to drive instruction. And that's where this literacy intervention system that I mentioned really comes into play. We have high quality diagnostic assessments that really pinpoint for our teachers how they can target instruction for all their students. And that's a hallmark of what we're doing as well. The other thing that I'm really excited about at 95% Group is our continuing expansion of text for students. We have a really unique product called Decodable Duo texts, and these are for kindergarten, first grade kids. And the first part of the book is text only. So kids are really focused instructionally on keeping their eyes on text, developing that decoding habit. The other part of the book is the same text, but with illustrations to help for further reading, for engagement, and for reading practice. We also have a whole series of books for second through fifth, and now we have a series of books for older students at a lower readability, and we call those readables. And again, these are high quality books that kids love. They love the themes. They're a way for kids to get immediately engaged with chapter books, and they're really high quality. So, between the wonderful teacher materials, the wonderful digital development that we're doing, and the text that we're providing for kids, we are just on this tremendous growth trajectory, and we're delighted to keep doing the work in classrooms with real kids and real teachers and providing best-in-class resources. And the last thing I would say is we are continuing to offer high-quality professional learning. We offer not just training to help teachers use our materials, but we also offer coursework in the science of reading and other types of professional topics that our teachers need to have access to. We have a comprehensive, on-demand, asynchronous course called Top 10 Tools, which is a wonderful way for teachers to get kind of that big picture, in-depth look at what do we mean by the science of reading, but more importantly, how does this inform your instruction? And then I think our crowning glory with professional learning is our coaching. I mentioned how important coaching is, and we offer best-in-class coaching. We coach around the country in school districts, we have a wonderful cadre of consultants and coaches all around the country to provide that work, that in-classroom, side-by-side supportive work for teachers.
So a lot going on, a lot
A
of
lot
excitement, it sounds
going
like. But
on.
what a wonderful way to have all of that stuff on your plate. And you've set your own goals for helping out with the science of reading and helping so many teachers across the country. Laura, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for being on the Reading Revolution.
Well, thank you. I mean, really, it's truly been my pleasure. Honestly, I am so proud to be part of the work, and I'm proud to be in this profession. It's a very, I always tell teachers that I work with, thank you for being in this profession. It's a noble profession, and you're doing important work. And so it's just a privilege to be here to talk about that. So thank you.
Well, I'm sure we'll stay in touch down the line. And again, thank you for your time and all the best to everyone at the 95% group.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate that.
For more information about the Reading Revolution, please visit bookvending.com. If you would like to contact us or would like to suggest a guest, drop us a line at readingrevolutionpod@gmail.com. The Reading Revolution is hosted by Josh Gregory, with technical direction from Thomas Crane and David Gagan. The podcast is produced by Jake Blumberg and Connor Russo. The executive producer is Jay Blumberg. Thanks again for watching and listening. We'll see you here again on The Reading Revolution, where literacy matters.